Hello, captives and captive friends, and welcome to episode 84 of the Global Captive Podcast, supported by the EY Global Captive Network and presented by me, Richard Kutcher. I am recording this intro from Atlanta, Georgia, on the eve of Riskworld, the huge risk and insurance conference organized by RIMS, and we should have some really exciting content recorded and produced here in the coming weeks, so do look out for that. Some really exciting interviews that I'm really looking forward to. It has also been another very busy week on the Captive Intelligence platform, with extensive reporting and analysis of the Internal Revenue Service's latest moves against captives making the 831B tax election. It really is analysis and commentary you will not find on any other captive insurance websites. And you may have heard our GCP short with EY, released on 26th of April. If you haven't and you want to understand what these latest proposed regulations mean for the 831B captive industry in particular, then I suggest scrolling to the previous episode and giving it a listen. Plenty of news too from Europe, with Malta surpassing 1 billion euros in captive assets under management, as well as response to the Luxembourg regulator revealing on this very podcast a few weeks ago that they would be open to discussing the introduction of PCCs in the domicile. All of those stories, features, and loads more can be found on the captiveintelligence.io website, and so do make sure you are visiting there regularly, and there is a link in the episode show notes as well. But let's get on then with GCP 84. No co-host this week, but we do have three brilliant segments coming up. In the second half, I'll be joined by three members of Seeker's Next Gen initiative: Claire Richardson of Hylent, Dylan Feringa at PNC Institutional Asset Management, and Bailey Rose, partner at Dentons. Bailey has been quoted extensively in our 831B coverage over the last 10 days or so. We will also have our first quarterly investments update of the year from Friends of the Podcast London and Capital, when Chadrak Khwaza and Rabani Wahab will make sense of what another eventful period means for captives. But first, we are going to start with our latest new captive owner interview. We are making a good habit of hearing stories firsthand of new captives being formed. I am pleased to say it is a familiar face back on the pod. Captive Intelligence revealed in February that Fluid Truck, an American commercial vehicle truck rental company, has established a captive in Washington, D.C., and their head of insurance since May 2022, Courtney Claflin, sat down with me at Seeker to tell us all about it. So, Courtney, great to have you back onto the Global Captive Podcast.
Thank you. I've always enjoyed this, and yeah, it's good to be back. Thanks.
So, and this is the first time we've had you on since you joined Fluid Truck. And as we reported on Captive Intelligence a few weeks ago, you recently set up a captive. But before we get to that, could you just tell us a little bit about Fluid Truck and what it does and your role there?
Yeah, Fluid Truck is a very, very dynamic, fast-growing technology company. We've got about 100,000 customers. And what it is it's peer-to-peer truck rentals. So pickup trucks to the panel vans and box vans. And what we do is the technology comes from the app. You download the app and you can go in and reserve, look for a vehicle. You can reserve a vehicle. And then you drive to that vehicle and you do a virtual walk around. We enable it. You take it for an hour, 5 minutes, 20 minutes, 2 days, a month, 6 weeks, whatever the case may be. And then you return it and you drive away.
And presumably you've joined Fluid Truck as head of insurance.
Yeah, I joined as head of insurance with the kind of the laser focus to build a captive for the company, to insure our risks and take advantage of captive financing, much like everybody else that does a captive.
Yeah, and obviously, so in the sector that Fluid Truck works in, and we've seen it in other technology companies in kind of gig economy, sharing economy, whatever you want to call that sector, you know, insurance is a challenge, right? Because the commercial insurance market doesn't necessarily fully understand or is fully confident in understanding the risks involved. So why is a captive just being chosen as the solution to kind of tackle those challenges?
Well, that's a good question. And I think like a lot of captives start, is that they start under the basic premise of two major things. Number one, control. And number two, to offset the commercial pricing of product. Yeah. Availability for, you know, our phase one is our vehicles, you know, and they're all over the country. And we've reached the point where our premiums far outstrip the claims. And so consequently, much like everybody else, you've got two main components behind the formation of a captive, which is capture the underwriting profits and corresponding investment income from your risk financing arrangement, and two, to control your own destiny and be able to chart it out yourself as opposed to being the tail on the dog.
So you got the captive licensed in DC?
Correct.
A place you know well for captive
Very
regulation?
Well. Yes, I've had a long-standing relationship with them. I enjoy the law. The law is fantastic. The regulators themselves, Sean, Dana, I have a very good relationship with them. I've built a lot of captives and a lot of programs with them. They know me. I know them. It's stable for me in the captive world.
So, and what is the captive insuring then? From
right now, phase one is going to be auto liability and auto physical damage. So, as I tell people, when you start your company with your captive with your core, and that's our core. And then I've got plans on the drawing board for future expansion that we'll get to, you know, hopefully in the near future. And either for other lines of coverage or for other types of risk financing arrangements. But much like every captive, you know, you start out with that core that drives you to the captive. And then from there, you let the brain go and you start thinking about all the things that you can do and what you've done in your past and your history. And then gradually keep pushing the needle.
And what unique challenge, as you said, you know, you've built captives before. Obviously, we all know you very well from particularly building the University of California captive. Was there any kind of new or unique challenges that the fluid truck captive project threw out for you, which you hadn't encountered before? Because I know you always say you're always learning, you always want to learn. So, you know, what were maybe some new things that you did learn in this process?
Yeah, I talk about it a lot because I'm going through it right now. You know, we're so fresh. I've never done technology, and I've never done a startup company that doesn't have legacy data. And I went through different phases of this construct for this particular captive that were, I don't know if the word baffling is the right word, but it was just head scratching because I didn't know the space. And I came walking into this thing thinking I was going to wipe the floor, it's going to be up and going, and it's going to be easy peasy lemon squeezy. Well, guess what? It's not. Yeah. And that's the coolest, which now in retrospect was the coolest part about building this particular captive is it's such a young company. You know, from we look at from an insurance age, it's a 2.5-year-old company. Yeah. And so it was, you know, getting data. With startup organizations, you know, they're technology company. They're not a traditional company that's been purchasing insurance for 10, 20, 30 years, where the insurance industry has taught them where to put the data in the bucket and what buckets to have. And here I walked in and it's like, where's the buckets? No fault of their own. It's just, it's they're tremendous. We're a great company, but so young that you had to go into it and say, okay, it's not sitting there ready to bake. I've got to make the ingredients. And it was really cool.
I mean, I would say it's definitely not a reflection on your company. It's a reflection on the commercial insurance market, which is still seems to struggle with new companies and new concepts. Like, I get that they need to have data, but if they want to underwrite the companies of tomorrow and don't want them all to go and set up their own captives, then they need to be more flexible perhaps with these kind of companies.
Yeah, that is such an excellent point, because, you know, when I'm out in the reinsurance markets and I'm out in the fronting markets, people are scratching their heads and they're going, well, wait a minute, you're brand new, your last mile delivery, your peer-to-peer rental, you want usage-based insurance, UBI. which is new. And insurance commissioners can't wrap their heads around it. Companies can't. How do you file for that? What are your filed rates? So it's new space, and that's made it, particularly at this point in my career, it's made it a just like, to quote a movie at some point in time that I never went to, it's an excellent adventure.
Yeah. Well, good luck for the rest of the adventure, and I'm sure we'll have you on back on the pod in a year or two's time to talk about the next chapter as well.
Yes, thanks for having me, and I look forward to it.
Always good to have Courtney back on the pod, and looking forward to catching up with him as well this week at RIMS. Now let's get our Q1 investments update from our friends at London and Capital. Shadrach Kwaza, Executive Director, and Rabani Wahab, Senior Fixed Income Fund Manager, discuss a pretty messy quarter involving inflation perhaps edging lower, a confusing jobs market, and of course the banking disruption we saw. And of course, what all of that means for captives and their investment managers.
So Rabani, can you give us a high-level summary of the macroeconomic sort of highlights over the last quarter and the outlook for the next few months?
Sure. We just released our macro quarterly, and one of the headlines for looking at what the first quarter gave us was it just got very messy. And it was actually very messy, especially towards the end of that first quarter. A combination of good things happening, which was inflation edging lower. But then the jobs market was the one thing which was keeping everybody confused as to, you know, which way the global economy is heading. And that was creating an awful lot of tensions for what the central banks themselves will be thinking going forward, given this backdrop. And it wasn't particularly messy, but then it was something which a lot of investors in particular were thinking that by this time, the jobs market would have been behaving itself in that there'll be a little bit more in the way of available jobs coming through. But then given all that, right towards the end, of course, we had a few issues with banks, which we'll talk about shortly. And that, I think, just created a little bit more, if you like, volatility into the way that central banks were thinking and how the markets responded. That's really the way that the first quarter ended up. I guess the most interesting thing is where to from here onwards. And the second quarter is probably no clearer than how the first quarter ended, in that we're not really getting something all that focused in terms of angles coming from the key economic indicators, such as jobs being, if you like, not quite as firm as we've got used to over the last couple of quarters. And inflation, whilst coming down, isn't really coming down at quite the pace in certain regions like the UK. However, in the US, it's behaving itself, but it's the core numbers, the core inflation numbers, which aren't really coming down as quickly as most had hoped. So that's sort of creating a little bit of a quandary for many. Our central case for the remainder of this year and going into 2024 is that it's going to be a soft landing, meaning that we're probably going to avoid a recession. Growth will probably come slower, but then the risk of hard landing, i.e. greater probability of a recession, is growing in the background, especially because of the banking developments.
Thanks for that, Rabani. You did mention banking, and there is a lot happening from an economic perspective, and we have had a lot in the news about a banking crisis and things of that nature. Is there a banking crisis brewing?
I think, you know, it's what we've had over the last few weeks. There were three in particular which caught headlines, and all of them were, if you like, different cases. But one thing which, answering your question, Shadrach, we're looking at is there's a certain sector of banks, and it's a very important sector of banks, which is the regional banks, mainly in the US. We don't have quite that level of regional bank exposure in the rest of the developed world. But in the US, you'll have read that back in 2020, there was a relaxation for some of these smaller banks, and a lot of the regional banks tend to be relatively small, for them not to maintain their balance sheets in quite the level of integrity that some of the larger banks have been told to. And so that sort of gave them a sort of a carte blanche to do what they wanted to. And it's most likely not going to be a banking crisis of sorts. But then I think it's come to a point where maybe the US regulators might think twice about giving, if you like, this leeway for the banks to do whatever they want to and just come back to where they used to be before 2020, that they have to provide all the level of risk reportings that they used to, just like what the other banks do. So we don't think it's going to be a major, major concern, but then we are, of course, looking very closely at the smaller banks in the US in particular.
And given the sort of failure that happened was a European bank, do you have any views in terms of the security of European banks, especially some of the major names that we are more familiar with?
Well, I think the European bank that we're referring to, of course, is Credit Suisse. And one difference between Credit Suisse and the other cohort that we follow and, of course, invest in is that Credit Suisse, for quite a few quarters, have been recording quarterly losses. And there wasn't really anything that they were doing to reverse that trend. And this one was very much about a bank that wasn't run as well as it should be. And so all of the other banks that we look at and follow have quite a different P&L profile, that they've been making profits in each quarter. And whenever there's some parts of its operations which haven't been doing as well as others, they've been doing things to balance revenue out from other sectors within their banking outfit. And that wasn't something which we saw from Credit Suisse. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why it, to us, is a very specific one-off type of event.
Thanks for that, Barney. That really clarifies things a lot. So we've spoken a lot about banking, but let's think about the wider economy. So outside of banking, is there anything that you're particularly worried about?
You know, outside of banking, one of the linked stories, of course, is real estate, and in specific, commercial real estate, and going even more specific, is the office component within commercial real estate. And, you know, if we sort of step back and have a look at how office space has evolved since lockdown, it's a very, very different environment to what we were accustomed to before 2020. And that's one of the things which is really being focused quite hard on, because in some allocations in the US in particular, there's a strategic allocation to real estate. But then when it comes to office in particular, we're just looking quite closely at it, because there's clearly a lot of concern going on, partly because of hybrid employment. And it doesn't look as though that there's going to be any change in the way that pattern has established itself anytime soon. And so what that leaves a lot of the real estate managers with is a conundrum that revenue is significantly lower. And also, of course, the cost of financing has gone up significantly as well. So this is one of the reasons why we've seen one or two headline defaults within office commercial real estate. So that's an area where we think there might be a few more headlines to come from over the weeks ahead.
Thanks for that, Barney. That is really interesting. So pulling back to captives, because this really is a captive podcast. So what about captives? A lot of captives that suddenly we've come across hold deposits in cash with banks or have loan backs. So for captives holding these types of assets, is there anything they should particularly be aware of or be looking at?
Well, you know, we always opt for safety when it comes to cash. And the whole world of holding cash has evolved since the bearing episode back in the 80s, last century. The way that we look upon cash is that it's a strategic asset within every captive's balance sheet. And, you know, because it's so important to the way that it operates, you shouldn't really be too far from the top banks when it comes to holding cash at a bank level. So it is fine to hold calls, but then it's good to hold calls in the top rated banks. And there's a list which is called the GSIBs, which is the Globally Systemically Important Banks, which is listed and created by the bank regulator. We feel safe with any call deposits being held in any of those banks. So if there are any cash or calls being held in names outside the G-SIB list, we would suggest moving them to, if you like, a more of a safe bank. And, you know, it might mean losing a few basis points, but then I think discretion is perhaps the key event here.
So thinking about sort of the wider assets that captives are invested in, you know, it tends to be fixed income or equities. What about those areas? Should captives be making any changes to their portfolios?
As we all know, last year, 2022, was a very challenging year for fixed income. And I'm sure some captives would have reduced the fixed income allocation compared to what the neutral position would normally be. Now, you know, the sort of economic landscape we're describing going forward here is a lot more fixed income centric in terms of how we see things going across the major asset classes. And what that means is that if captives had been underweight and are still underweight fixed income, I think one of the things which we would like to see is to be at least at neutral levels, if not a little bit above those neutral levels within fixed income. And given that there's a residual risk of a hard landing coming through, that's probably a good thing for us to reappraise the higher beta assets, such as equities, to reduce that to no more than the neutral level. And if any of the captives were overweight any of these areas, that would be one thing which we would recommend they look at. And just coming back, one final thing within fixed income, focus should really be on the high grade part of the fixed income universe. And by that, we mean a combination of government bonds as well as high investment grade with the minimal of sub-investment grade allocation.
Useful information. So aside from sort of the broad asset class allocation comments you've made there, is there anything else captive owners and managers should be looking at when looking at their portfolios? I guess especially given, you know, where inflation is and the fact that that would have an impact on their costs from a liability perspective. Is there anything worth keeping in mind?
Well, I think we're looking at the discount curves for not just captives, but in all insurance companies. And the discount curve, we think, is going to edge lower over the next 12 months. So when it comes to the value of the liabilities, we will probably see a upward shift in those liability profiles, which, you know, if we're not matching that as well as we could do using high quality fixed income, that might introduce a little bit of a, if you like, a profitability surprise if it's not closely matched to what's likely to be a lower discount yield curve going into 2024. So that would be one of the things which we'd like to promote. And, you know, by doing that, sticking to the high quality end will probably immunize an awful lot of that shift to the lower discount rate curve.
Thanks for your time, Rabani. Hopefully speak to you soon.
Sure. Thanks, Shadrach.
Thank you, Shadrach and Rabani, for that insight as ever. Really valuable and interesting. So one of my other highlights when attending SICA in recent years is actually catching up with those involved with the association's Next Gen Committee and initiative. There has been a very obvious and welcomed demographic shift at the event in recent years, and much of that has been down to a big effort made by SICA President Dan Toll and his board to make it an appealing and welcoming environment for new and young captive professionals to take part in. I caught up with three SICA members taking an active part in these efforts. So over the next 15 minutes, you'll hear from Claire Richardson of Highland, Dylan Feringa at PNC Institutional Asset Management, and Bailey Rose, partner at Dentons, on why they have got involved and what appeals to them about the captive insurance industry. Claire, you've actually been on the podcast before, haven't you? Or have you not? I've been on your podcast.
Yes, you have. I haven't been on GCP yet, so this is a great opportunity.
So Claire, tell us a little bit about yourself and your current role in the industry.
Yeah, absolutely. So I am with Highland Global Captive Solutions as a captive consultant. I'm based out of Indianapolis, and I've been with the firm for about 2.5 years now.
Fantastic. And what do you do at Highland?
So I help with all of the education of prospective stakeholders, current stakeholders of captive insurance programs, and companies that are looking to kind of put together a captive program. So I help with all of the feasibilities and presentations and various elements of those as well, converse with domiciles and different regulators, as well as working with the marketplace to put some really interesting captive programs together.
Fantastic. And Dylan, tell us a little bit about yourself and your role in the industry.
Yeah, no, thank you for that. So my name is Dylan Feringa. I'm with PNC Institutional Asset Management, but I sit in our Insurance Solutions Group. So I'm an assistant vice president in that group, and my whole focus is in investment consulting for captives, so developing prudent investment strategies to ensure that they're supporting the kind of overall impetus as to why the captive was formed, so those claims in there. I've been in the investment management space now for around 5 years.
Fantastic. Good to have you on the pod. And Bailey, how about yourself?
Yes. My name is Bailey Rose. I am a partner at Denton's Bingham Greenbaum. I'm based in Columbus, Ohio, and I am a tax attorney. So I work with captives across the board, whether it be during one of the dreaded IRS audits and assisting with their kind of information document requests, tax court cases. But I also help with captive governance, formation, kind of overall strategic questions, just to make sure that everything is on the up and up from a tax perspective.
All the really easy stuff.
That's right. The very sexy stuff. Yeah.
So, Bailey, you also work with a man who has been on the podcast a few times. Many people know Chas Lavelle. Great guy, I imagine, to work for. How did you come to be involved with captives at Denton's?
Yes. So, you know, in real estate, they always say that location is the most important thing. And for me, the location happened to be that I just worked three doors down from Chas. Yeah. And so he's just an incredibly brilliant, kind, and generous person. And so I always loved talking to him. And then, of course, once you get him engaged about what he does day to day, he's extremely passionate about it. So I kind of started out in the captive space, helping Chas with some of these 831B audits. And I would sit in on these 8-hour long IRS onslaught interviews of captive owners, and I just was really fascinated by kind of the overall reasons that captives exist and why these small businesses seek to start a captive, because I mean their company is really their baby, and they want to be sure that the things that keep them up at night are going to be insured. They're going to have some risk management there. And so I just found it to be an incredibly interesting industry, and so I've just gotten more and more involved over the years working with Chas and learning more about the captive space.
And now you're like headlining the tax panels here at Seeker, and you seem to be about a few years ago it was always Tom Jones, Bruce Wright, and Chas and Skip Myers was on the kind of corporate law side, and it's been interesting to see kind of that generational change. And obviously Dan Casada has been involved from Crow, and now we're seeing you on there. We've seen Mike or Paul from EY on those panels. So I think it's nice to see, like, those guys are legends in our industry. Yes. But it's really nice to see kind of new blood coming through and new perspectives. So well done on
Thank
that.
You.
On breaking
Thank you.
Into
no,
that
a,
exclusive
a privilege
crowd.
To be part of it. So that's good. Good plug.
Dylan, what are you finding most rewarding, interesting kind of so far about the captive industry?
Yeah, you know, I think just how dynamic it is. You know, every captive that we work with, there's always a different level of nuances that they're running through the captive, why they formed a captive, what risk lines, also seeing risk lines that you could never have thought have been insured. And so I think this is the dynamic of it. And I think the kind of other aspect is just the dedication that everyone in like the industry has. Everyone's always wanting to help each other. And so you kind of see where it is a small group of people in this industry. There's tons of money flowing through it. It's a large industry, but from a people perspective, it's small, but it's a really tight knit community. And so I think, you know, those are the aspects that really just kind of intrigued me and has kind of kept me interested in this space. And I don't really see myself going anywhere else.
Yeah, what you say about it from a people perspective, it's small. Like, I definitely understand what you mean. My colleague Luke Harrison is here at Seeker for the first time, and you know, he was obviously with me yesterday, and he was like, Richard, you know everyone here. I'm like, well, I've been coming to this conference for like 8 years, so you do start to build up all those contacts. But as you say, the numbers are big in terms of the amount of money that go through captives, the amount of assets they insure. It's incredibly impressive, and I think often underrated. Claire, you are a alumni of Butler University. You've had a few of your fellow students, former peers on the podcast before, and some of your professors as well. What was it about the captive experience you gained at Butler that made you want to pursue this sector as a career?
Those professors were honestly instrumental in getting me the exposure to the various elements of the captive courses that we do have at Butler, as well as working with Gamma Iota Sigma. I took a lot of time to really invest in myself and in my university education. And with that process, I had some hands-on experience with the captive, really working with the service providers as well as the students in the course, serving as the student CEO during my senior year. It really got my hands dirty, and I realized it was something that was very much a sustainable business decision for my career. And I got really interested in it, so much so that I was able to do an independent study course at Butler only on captives, which had not been done previously, which I think really exponentially increased my ability to be successful in my internship with Highland, ultimately landing me here. So
yeah, the Butler course is a real fascinating one. And when the news first came out about Butler setting up this student run captive, and you know, it looked like a great initiative, but these things can always end up just being looking like a gimmick or looking like just being a thing that was done and didn't follow on. But I think the proof's in the pudding that so many of yourself and fellow students who have ended up working at different captive management houses and brokers and focus on captives, I think obviously that initiative really did work in piquing your interest and giving you a great grounding in that. So it'd be great to see other universities do things similar, because I think we all know that we need more and more talent into the captive industry. So tell us a bit then about the Seeker Next Gen initiatives. What have you got out of it so far, Claire, in terms of being involved with Seeker and the Next Gen committee?
Having some serious support has been amazing. Honestly, coming into the industry and definitely somebody who was relatively young, newer to the industry, not knowing what's really going on from a conference perspective. When I first started attending, I was able to meet some fantastic individuals that, you know, started the Next Gen Committee. And from there, they've really served as fantastic mentors and really helped me build my own personal board of directors and move in a way that has been successful in my career and participating in other areas of the industry, which I would love to continue.
How about you, Bailey? What have you got out of being kind of connected to the Next Gen?
Yeah, sure. So I am still relatively new to this space. So though I've been an attorney for a while, it's really only been the last 3 or so years that I've gotten way more involved in the captive industry. And before I came to my first captive conference, I was able to be introduced to Joe McDonald, who was on the Next Gen committee. And, you know, Chaz had met him at an event and said, oh, you know, this initiative sounds great. You know, you've got to meet my partner, Bailey. And so he and I were able to have a Zoom call. I was able to join a subcommittee kind of even before coming to a conference. And it just made it so much more welcoming of an environment to be able to walk into a room full of people and say, oh wait, I already know, you know, 5 people from this subcommittee. And so I can go up and talk to them and they're going to introduce me to who they work with. And the circles just sort of expand out from there. And so I've found it so valuable to have sort of that in where I, you know, Chaz is great at introducing me around, but it is nice sometimes to not have to feel like you're the puppy dog, like following behind the big dog in the house. It's nice to be able to feel like you have some you know, your own kind of network and your own circle that you can be a part of.
We definitely need to tell Chaz that you just refer to him as the big dog.
What breed of dog do you think? I'm gonna have to give that some thought, but
yeah, I've got all kinds of ideas running through my mind which I'll restrain from saying. So Dylan, why do you think such kind of these initiatives, the Next Gen initiatives at Seeker is important, and what have you got out of it?
Yeah, so I mean, I think from an important standpoint, it helps this next generation coming into this industry really build their network. And I think that is a challenging kind of aspect that a lot of, as a newer person coming into the captive industry, they see, you know, these thousands of people at the conference and they don't know anyone. So having that next gen group where, you know 5 people out of the 1,000, but guess what? Those 5 people know other people and they're able to make those introductions. So I think that's one important aspect of that, of just being able to help build your network. But I think from another aspect too is like learning. You get to learn from everyone in the Next Gen committee. What do you do? What do you do in the industry? no one's there to try and pitch what they're doing or try and, you know, it's not a sales type environment. It's how can we all learn? How can we better each other? And how can we just get people positioned into, you know, an aspect where we're speaking on panels, where, you know, we're getting exposure in the industry that we likely would not have gotten by not joining the initiative?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. So in terms of, we touched, Claire, on obviously what Butler did in you know, training people and getting people interested in captives. How do you think we can, as an industry, spread the word and make the captive industry more appealing to graduates and other young professionals? It's a tough question, I guess. But
yeah, it's kind of loaded. But something that I think really helped with my understanding of the captive industry is really taking a chance on a lot of these students that might not know what they're looking to do. Continue investing in, you know, RMI programs or programs outside of RMI, because we all know that, you know, the graduates from those very specific programs are fantastic, but there's not enough of them to go ahead and fill those holes and gaps that the older generation leaves when they're retiring in the next 5-10 years. So it really gives the younger generation a lot of opportunity. So for the current generation in the industry, continue investing, whether that means funds or time or mentorship opportunities or internship opportunities. Really make yourself known, show up for these students, and they will do the same for you.
So Chaz found you pretty late in terms of a succession plan. Not to say anything about Chaz's age, but how do you view it? Like, do you already kind of think about how can we make sure that we've got more talent coming into, whether specifically the attorney side, in captives, or more broadly?
Yes, absolutely. So I'm really hoping to start investing in our associates early. I think it's really difficult for one person to do, you know, what we do. And so to be able to begin having those conversations early in their career and, you know, let them know what captives are all about, maybe give them an opportunity to come to these conferences, because that's when I think you really get the spark of how exciting the industry is. And so I think it's really tough. You know, we think of this question of how we attract and retain new talent as a really intimidating question, a really hard question. But I also think we have the answers as an industry if we are just intentional about it. You know, this is a really creative industry. It's an industry that it's people who want to get to yes. We want to be helpful to our clients. We want to be helpful to one another. And those are the kinds of, I think, attributes that are going to lead us to attract new talent, retain new talent. You know, if we can welcome them in, I think that they will stay. That's the sense that I get when I look around at this close-knit group of people who've worked in this industry for years. We just need to find the way to reach out to the, you know, folks, and not even, you know, not even just young folks, but people who are looking for a career change, people who might be looking for a pivot because of, you know, their particular interests or what their talents are. So I think there's a lot of opportunity here for sure.
Dylan, if you were talking to kind of friends of yours or colleagues or peers in similar industry and they are interested about captives, how would you kind of sell it to them? Like, what would you say is the kind of the appealing part of it?
Yeah. You want to have fun? No, I'm just kidding. You know, what I always tell them, and this is, you know, with broadly speaking with, you know, my investment management background, there was a lot of kind of, you kind of saw, kept seeing the same thing. And it did become mundane, somewhat boring. And, you know, as I got into the captive industry and started kind of at consulting with the different insurers, understanding their different risk lines in there, and seeing how each insurer's portfolio that we develop from an investment standpoint is substantially different from the next. And I think that's the biggest thing that I've talked to interns coming through in our PNC Institutional Asset Management Group. I've talked to analysts about it, even just trying for us to recruit more talent for our own team. It's how dynamic it is and how you're it's not a one and done deal when you're working with these captives. There's a constant readjustment in their portfolios. You're constantly, you know, trying to talk to, like on Claire's end, what's happening within the captive, talking from the tax standpoints. Everyone's interconnected. And I think that's the aspect of it where it's just not a day-to-day, it's always the same. You're always going to see something different, or you're going to be like, wow, I've never seen that before. That's interesting. And it's just something that kind of builds into your kind of repertoire of just, wow, okay, I saw this. And down the line, you may run into a, you know, a client who's like, well, we want to do this in captive. Have you ever seen that? And we're like, oh, wait, we did see this. It was interesting, but kind of here's what happened, and let's get you connected with them. So I think, you know, if I'm selling it to someone, it's the how dynamic it is. It's ever-changing. You're not going to have the same day. It's always you're going to find little nuances and differences that's really going to make it fun.
Well, thank you to Claire, Dylan and Bailey for that discussion. Another three very impressive individuals from our industry. That is all we have time for, though, in GCP 84. And I hope you found it another valuable insight into the global captive industry. Thank you to Courtney Claflin of Fluid Truck and London & Capital's Shadrach Kwaza and Rabani Wahab, who joined us in the first half. In the meantime, stay safe, stay well, and see you next time, captives.